I want to be sure I'm on. It's green now. Okay. I was looking in the back, and there's a whole bunch of tomatoes, and then I saw people walking in with a tomato in their hand. So I want to be behaving. I know where the door is if I start seeing red flying at me here. Good to see y'all tonight. Glad you came out, and I hope this is a good evening for us together. I've enjoyed very much the opportunities that have been given to me, both in talking with a number of individuals, as well as having the opportunity to publicly present to you at the congregation here. Hopefully this has been a good weekend. I certainly want to thank Forrest and Terry and Willow for sharing their home and letting me be the first to break in their new basement. It sleeps well, and it's nice having that there the time I've been there. They're just gracious hosts, and I really appreciate that, and I believe you have quite a jewel in your preaching family here. I just think that's really, really good, especially good to see young people preaching the gospel. I was reminiscing a little bit with Forrest because his dad and I walked the streets of Sioux City, Iowa, and I think Monon, Indiana, doing door-to-door evangelism. And I just remember Mac and I were out there together for a little while, just the two of us, and we covered a number of houses and a number of experiences where we were welcomed and not so welcome. And I remember walked up on one guy that was raking his yard, and he didn't have time to talk, so we grabbed rakes and raked his yard as we talked to him. And he ended up coming to services, he and his wife both. I don't know if that was a payoff for us raking his yard or not. But it was good to be reacquainted with the McMurray family again, and to see the next generation. And I think that's the first experience I've had working with the father and the son in evangelistic efforts. So that's just really refreshing, and good to see young people that are interested in taking the gospel and have that fresh energy coming out of the gate, eager to learn and ready to serve. I thank the elders here, Mike and, did I get it right? Mike and Dave? Yeah. Kevin and Greg, Dave, okay. All right. I called someone named Sharon, I called Phyllis the other day, but that was close too. But names sometimes elude me, but I remember the faces, and it's certainly good to share in the gospel here with, I appreciate the elders inviting me and setting up this opportunity. Tonight I want to talk with you and appreciate all you good brethren. We've talked to a number of people who have bared their souls. And that is, I think, one of the most wholesome things about these kinds of efforts is people that can just, that will get down and dig deep and be honest and lay the cards out. Let's see what we're dealing with and then see what we need to do about it. And I just think that's very refreshing when people are not trying to hide but trying to resolve. The Bible says whoever confesses and forsakes their sins will prosper. And sometimes it's not even about sins. It's just about we got situations in life, we don't know what to do about it, and we need to run them by somebody. So I'm kind of hoping that this weekend has been kind of a prototype, if you haven't had that experience, more of a prototype of how we can talk to each other and be open with each other, not particularly judging each other, especially when someone is laying their problems out and saying, I want some help with it. That's not a time to jump up and say, you did what? That's a time to say, let's see how we can fix this. Let's bring the Lord in on this, and let's get some forgiveness going here and get this thing hidden in a good direction. I just think that's really refreshing, and I commend you as a church for providing that opportunity. Commend Forrest for his expertise in sitting and listening and absorbing and feedback, and that's just been a delightful experience. We've done that from Friday about 1 o'clock until today, and today's wasn't able to materialize, but a whole bunch yesterday. So with all that said, let me talk about in this last lesson about affecting change. Change is very difficult. Many people say they would like to change, and yet it's difficult for them to bring that about. I want to start by talking about recommend a book if you would like to see this, and it's a book called Stages of Change, by Prochaska and De Clemente, and there's another one out there that I forget that name, but there's three of them. And basically, what this book talks about is how people go about the change process. And ultimately, what it says is some people are pre-contemplative. That is, that okay, here's some options people can do. They may not have any interest in doing it. It's just kind of a curiosity. And then contemplative is, well, maybe I need to do something. And then there are the action steps, and then the stabilization stages, where people are kind of setting a new track and trying to stay on habit with, on track with new habits. And what in this book, what it portrays, and I've thought so often about how this applies to evangelism and to the conversion process, because it's about change too. And I've thought so much that sometimes people are just kind of, they're exposed to the gospel and it's just kind of not a big deal to them. And then they start realizing, well, that's really talking about me. Maybe I need to make some changes, but they aren't quite ready. And then the action stages and so forth. You can read that book if you'd like to. It's available out in used book sections of your internet somewhere, or you can buy it in a bookstore or whatever. It's a pretty common book, not very expensive. Those gentlemen are from out of the University of South Florida in Tampa, which some of you all would be familiar with, that university. And basically what I would like to also talk about is some motivational interviewing techniques, and you can find those, probably you find what you need just out there, type in motivational interviewing on your computer, and it'll tell you a little bit about how to do that. And what motivational interviewing is really about is how do you motivate people to bring about change? And so this stages of change and the motivational interviewing materials generally run together. And motivational interviewing is not about let's go head-to-head and see who wins. This is really about rolling with resistance, or as Rollinette calls it, resisting the writing reflex. He's British, and so you can hear how he would say that. But what he's saying is that sometimes when we get in conflict with people, we have to be right. Fact is, I would say that's true most of the time, is that we want to be right, and in order for us to be right, you have to be wrong. What he says is that probably is not the most productive of ways to approach things, that as we talk with individuals, sometimes what we do is if we go with what they're saying, they will draw their own conclusion that they're not too sure that'll work. And he talks a little bit about some techniques in there that I'll leave that for you in your study. But that's an area where it's not a conflict model, it's not a head-to-head model, but it's like kind of like give them an inch, give them enough rope and they'll hang themselves. And that's the old adage. But that's the concept behind it. It's like, well, all right, if we do it your way, then what, and then what, and then what? And ultimately what they'll say is, well, you know, that won't work. And so they essentially back themselves in a corner. That's an approach that certainly can be effective. So you may want to put that in your bag of tools. What I want to suggest tonight is that change is inevitable. We live in a changing world. Everything about us is changing. Our bodies are changing from the time we come on the scene to the time we leave the scene. Our bodies are in a state of flux or a state of change. I want to also state that if we learn anything from the Bible, what we learn is change can be uncomfortable, and change can also be a major challenge to us. When Abraham was told to leave his family and to get up and take his belongings and to go to a land I'll show you, you don't know where you're going, but get up and go anyway. That was a challenge, and it was a challenge to change. It was a challenge to go somewhere that you don't know what's going to happen. The thing about change, I think, that is difficult is that there's a great deal of uncertainty in it. So whether we are going and applying the grief and loss, or whether we're dealing with depression, or whatever it is, we're talking about looking at life differently, approaching life differently. It may be different geographically, or it may be different emotionally. It may be a different approach as how we use a thing. What I also learn is that we tend to get in ruts. And if we were to do some brain studies, what we would point out is that that our brains develop channels. Just like if we took water, water will find its natural course. And once it finds its natural course, it will create channels or grooves. We've all seen water roll down a hill, and we know it creates a groove, and next water is going to find that same groove. And the more water rolls down the hill, the deeper the grooves are. In our brains work very similar. And once we get used to doing a thing, it is very familiar for our brain to do the same thing that it knows how to do over and over and over again, and that becomes automatic reflexes. So we just automatically go certain places in our brains when we have certain events that happen. It's a way of thinking. It can become a way of life. The challenge of the gospel is to change your way of thinking. And what that means is that it's going to be very difficult at first not to think the old way, because we're so used to things going this way that when we're asked to make them go this way, we have to do that on a very conscious level. That's true when we make changes about how we approach mental illness or how we approach making a change in the way that we deal with our family. And those changes can be difficult. You remember the Israelites of old when they left Egypt, that the text says they longed for the flesh pots of Egypt. Remember Korah and his company that wanted to pull off in a rebellion and go back to Egypt? I wonder what they would have told them. Well, we know all your army got wiped out in the Red Sea, but you know, we came back, we want things to be the way they were. And often, even though the way things have been miserable for us, they are familiar for us. And so we're willing sometimes to put up with that which is miserable simply because it is familiar. Now, if there is going to be any effective change in our situation, we have to get comfortable with accepting what is not familiar. We need along the way to have people who are our tour guides. Those would be folks that coach and encourage and kind of help guide us in those directions. That can be your elders, our shepherds. It could be any of the members of the church here. It could be maybe if you're in the community, it might be someone who would be a sponsor or someone that helps you to kind of think through and to start rethinking or thinking a different way. Now, while I'm on that subject, I do want to say this, that in the community, there are a number of resources. I'm not real big on the church not supplying our needs. But sometimes the community has opportunities that are there for us too, and they do that, and that's what they do, and they do it well in some cases. So in your community, you will have support groups, and those support groups are going to be found through your mental health centers or through a mental health hotline. If you call 211, not 911, but 211, you will be able to access all the resources in Illinois. And in Missouri or in Indiana or whatever, 211 is a hotline. And what you do is you tell them what you want. If you just need someone to talk to, you can call and say, I just need someone to talk. And there'll be folks there to talk to you. It's a 24/7 service, and that's what they do. That's part of what your tax dollars at work do. So if you don't like paying taxes, at least get some value out of it and call 211. That line is also available for people who are feeling suicidal, for situations where maybe someone's had a breakup and they just need somebody to talk to, and other folks are tucked away in bed, and if they answer the phone, they're so groggy they're not making good sense. Well, hang up and call 211. That will be a resource for you. And what you'll be able to do is to find some of these places. Now, I'm just going to mention these briefly, and then we're going to really get into our lesson tonight. But there are support groups. A support group is not a therapy group. It is merely a group of people that are just like you that have the same issue that you're calling them about. There are bipolar support groups. There are depression support groups. There's autism support groups. There is AA, which is Alcoholics Anonymous. There's Narcotics Anonymous for people that are on drugs. There's Cocaine Anonymous. There's ACOA, which is Adult Children of Alcoholics, the whole bunch of them in the same room talking about some of the effects that have been brought in their life and what to do about those. These are about self-help, not commiseration. And then there are some other groups like CODA, which is codependency. groups, and a lot of times some of our brethren need to go to those, because what they have done is they have inadvertently fallen into the role of being the rescuer and out here trying to do and do and do and save and save and be walked on and let people abuse them and use them. Sometimes domestic violence gets in there. The CODA groups can be a very effective set of groups for us. And what those are is basically how to stop the cycle of having people walk all over us. And some of that advice is worth our paying attention to, and some isn't. So you have to go in with a sieve and keep the stuff that'll help you and leave the stuff that won't. But there's always gold nuggets in there when you go to those kinds of groups. For those that are into some of the internet addictions, there are some groups that can help with that. The one that I would suggest is SA, which is Sex Addicts Anonymous, and this is for people that have a problem with pornography or with the chat rooms. And the reason I say SA, not right, if you're writing, write this down, not SAA. SAA says any sexual activity is acceptable, and we're going to help you to bring that back in range. I wouldn't be for that group. But the SA is about fidelity in marriage. It's about how to be faithful to your partner, how not to be in love with your computer and use that instead of your wife, and how not to go out to the internet to find a relationship instead of having a relationship with your husband. So SA, and with that is a group called Essanon, which is the counterpart. That's for the partner of the person that is abusing the computer. And so there's several opportunities out there. By the way, there's Al-Anon as well, and that deals with codependency. Anyway, the point I want you to see is that there's a lot of support that is out there. Those groups meet, many of those groups meet daily somewhere in a community near you, probably in this community. So they're within driving distance of you, and there what you will find is a group of people that are going to talk about situations. They'll talk about maybe they pick a topic and how that topic applies to that situation and so forth. But they are there to help each other, support each other, and they often exchange phone numbers to the degree people are willing to do that. And you can call people 24/7, and these are the people, when they give you their phone number, they're saying, "I'm available if you need me, call me." When we say these are anonymous groups, what anonymous means is we're not there to make friends. We're not there to find out what you do, where you work, how important you are, even what your last name is or what your occupation is. What we're here to do is to address this problem. And so that's what those are about. That's why they go by first names, and you may want to check those groups out. I would say this also while I'm having this conversation, is that you do want to check the listings, and you'll find those a lot of time on the computer, or you can call Central Services, and you'll find that in your phone book or however you access phone numbers, Central Services, and that's the clearinghouse that tells you where all these meetings are and all those activities, and where you can buy literature and different kinds of things. There's a whole network out there, and a lot of times we're not aware of that. Sometimes because we're so ashamed of the problem, we don't realize there's all kinds of help out there for us. In addition to support groups, there are the therapy groups that generally are through our community mental health. When I say community mental health, there are for-profit agencies out there as well. They're going to charge you. And if you have insurance, your insurance will cover a big chunk of that. But in the community mental health, those are sliding scale. And what that means is that they charge you based on your income. If you don't have much of an income, then 20% of zero is how much? It's still zero. I think they do have a minimum charge of $4 a session, something like that. But you can check those out, and there are opportunities there. And in community mental health centers, you're going to be dealing with those that have more of the credentials and they're more into the therapy end of it, usually in some kind of groups. Some places will have what's called monitoring groups, and those are a pretty low cost, usually about $20 a session. And what that basically is for people that say, I don't have a problem, and the family says, yeah, you do. And so these are kind of you go to a monitoring group, and what a monitoring group is basically says, if you don't have a problem, prove it. And if you think they have a problem, then you prove it. And so you go in here, and now we talk about these things, and ultimately we determine is there a problem or isn't there a problem. So that's kind of a conflict resolution kind of group. And you can get in those. Those are about $20 a piece, and they usually meet once a week, and so forth. You'll have a little bit of a plan with that and some assessments and some things. But those are activities available to you in your community. When I just talked about support groups, and I'm spending too much time on this, but when I talked about support groups, one of the things with a support group is that that they have closed meetings. That's just for the people that have the problem. And they have what they call open meetings. Now, an open meeting, anybody can go. Anyone in this auditorium can go to that open meeting. You don't have to have a problem to go to those meetings. You simply are going to the meeting to observe, see what's going on, and so forth. And usually they'll have a speaker at those meetings that's going to give what's called a lead, and that speaker is going to kind of tell their story from start to finish about how they got caught up in all whatever they're caught up in. So what you may want to do is get familiar. I always say if I'm going to refer people to something, I want to know what I'm referring them to. So maybe I need to drop in and see what the deal is. You can take it from there. But those are opportunities right in your community. Now, change calls upon us to be adaptable. And I want to go to the book of Philippians, the fourth chapter, just a moment. We're going to get to this slide in just a second. But in the book of Philippians, the fourth chapter, and verses 6 through 9, the apostle here talks to us about, he says, in nothing be anxious, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known unto God. And the peace of God, which passes all understanding, shall guard your heart and your thoughts in Christ Jesus. Finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honorable, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, and whatsoever things are of good report, if there be any virtue, if there be any praise, think on these things. The things you have both learned and received and heard and saw in me, these things do. And the God of peace shall be with you. Now I want you to notice in that passage that there's a promise that God will be with you, and also that the Lord is at hand, and the peace of God that passes all understanding is going to guard our hearts if we do these things. Now this is kind of a summary of what we've talked about this weekend, isn't it? And what he says in these verses, actually verse 4 talks about rejoice in the Lord always. But now he says in verse 6, in nothing be anxious. Don't let your stress go so far that it becomes anxiety, to where you're worrying and fretting and losing sleep over it. You know, God, things are going to work out right. One thing I learned when I was working one of those suicide hotlines, and we would get callers that would tell me, I've got a gun in my mouth and I'm going to pull the trigger and I just want to let somebody know before I do it. Those are disturbing calls to get. I've had a few of those calls. And what I usually do on those calls is I'll ask the person to ask them, will they commit to talk to me for 20 minutes? That's all I want, 20 minutes. And here's the reason I say that. Because I know that whatever the anxiety is or whatever the stressor is, that 20 minutes from now it will look different. And so if that person will stay with me for 20 minutes, it's not magic I do, but it's simply at the crisis cycle, the top of the crisis cycle when a person's ready to act out, they can't hold that level of energy for a long time. And if they will stay with me for 20 minutes, we'll talk about whatever they want to talk about, even if it's a little crazy. But if they can stay with me 20 minutes, things are going to look very different. And so I work with individuals to basically have that 20-minute conversation. And then what we usually do is we get to what we call extinction, which often is the person just says, yeah, I guess I do need to go get some help. We start talking about the future. We start talking about things that are special to them, like people, places, and things that are special to them, and kind of pulling some of that recall back. What I want to suggest is the book or the passage says, "Don't be anxious." And so children of God need to ride things out, things that may seem like the worst thing could ever happen. 20 minutes from later, it'll look different. I'll guarantee you that. If it doesn't, you call me, and we'll have a talk about that. But it'll look different in 20 minutes. So nothing, no matter how distressing, is going to last more than about 20 minutes. Now, I think most of us have the endurance to last 20 minutes, and you can kind of keep that in mind. But notice what he says. He talks about our attitude. Don't be anxious, but in everything, by prayer and supplication, that is, let's talk to God about it. We've talked about that this week. But he says, with thanksgiving. Thanksgiving. That needs to be something that's a part of us, that we have a thankful spirit, that we aren't just looking at what's wrong, that we are also looking at what's right. With thanksgiving for what's right, with thanksgiving, and we let our requests be made known to God. So that our life should not be one big gripe session. That there are good things and there are bad things. And sometimes people might trip that by saying, well, look on the bright side. And there usually is a bright side to everything that's going on with us. There is something that we can find that would be worth looking at and worth being thankful for. Maybe even the fact that we are able to feel pain. I talk to people sometimes that have chronic pain issues, and I talk to them about how they need to be thankful. It's no fun to hurt, but can you imagine what it's like not to hurt, not to have pain? The leprosy of the New Testament and the Old Testament, the leprosy was often thought to be a rotting of the skin from the inside out. But actually, when you go and look at modern-day leprosy, what you find is that it's a neurological problem. And basically, people lose their ability to feel. So when you're not feeling, guess what happens when your body doesn't tell you something's wrong? And you're walking along, and you kick your foot into the curb, but you don't know you're hurting. You may not even know you're bleeding. You lose your ability to feel. And then with that, infection sets in and various things like that. You know, one person prayed, "Thank you, Lord, for pain." Now, that person was in excruciating pain. But they learned to be thankful for pain because without that pain, they wouldn't know anything was wrong. Now, sometimes it's hard to be thankful for some things, but we need to look and see what is the other side of the equation. Don't just look at the downside. There is an upside there that we need to look at as well. But notice the promise that goes with going to God in this behalf with that attitude, and the promise that is here is the God of and the peace of God that passes all understanding shall guard your heart and your thoughts in Christ Jesus. Does that sound like a promise? When you do the first part, God gives you something in return. When we go to God with prayer and supplication, when we go with thanksgiving in our heart, not just gripe session, then what happens is there is a peace that God gives us. Our burden gets lifted is the way that what this is saying. And then he says that what we need to do is to focus on in life, and this is, again, about change. I'm going to tell you how to get there in just a minute. But this is about change. And what he says is, here's the things you need to let go through your mind. There are some things that we need to put a stop, no entry zone, time out, don't say that. We need to do some what we call thought stopping. So we stop the thoughts. But what we do here is, in place of those thoughts, the instead ofs, what we do is what the things that are honorable, things that are just, that are pure, that are lovely, and that are of good report. And what he says is you need to think on these things. Remember the other day when I talked to you about maybe you don't want to watch the news the first thing in the morning? This is what I'm talking about. Maybe in our conversations when we say, how are you doing, we don't go down our neurotic list of all that's wrong with us. Maybe what we do in those times is that we at least balance it with here's some things that are wrong and here's some things that are right. And this text would suggest that, that we focus on those things that we have and not on the things we don't have. You may want to type that out and put that on your mirror. And I want you to notice with this also that verse 9 gives a promise with that. And the God of peace shall be with you. Did you notice how that word peace is in there? It's about that's about resolution. It's about resolving that God's in charge, He's handling this, and it's going to be okay, even though it doesn't seem that way right now. We get ourselves in tight spots. So the question is, how are we going to affect change in our life? And I want to suggest just several things tonight, and then I'm going to talk about guarding our heart for just a moment. But we need to remember that our primary responsibility is very simple. All you have to worry about is just doing the next right thing. You don't have to worry about the whole enchilada. You just need to worry about doing the next right thing. And if you do the next right thing, and then after that you do the next right thing, then you're going to be in a series of doing the next right thing. And sometimes we need some help in knowing what the next right thing is. But basically, obeying God's will is the next right thing. So the question of what would God have me to do may be the challenge is here before us. We need to go to the Lord and seek the Lord for wisdom. Our Jeremiah passage would talk about that. And we need to seek the Lord for wisdom, to ask for His grace and for His calm. And what we need to do is try not to run ahead of the Lord, but to and don't get in His way. Did you ever notice the characters in the Bible that got in God's way and then God had to kind of fix it? Remember Jonah got in God's way and God had to fix that? Remember others like Abraham that decided he would intervene in God's plan and we'll figure out how to get the promised child here without the way God had planned it. And so out pops Ishmael. For about 14 years, he's assumed to be the son of promise, but he wasn't. And then along comes Isaac, and there was conflict then because Abraham and Sarah tried to run and to get in God's way in God's plan. So what we need to learn is patience and that God's time is not our time. And so we need to wait on the Lord, and sometimes we need to stand still in that process and wait on the Lord. When the Lord's ready to move, the Lord will move, and sometimes what we need to do is just stand still and wait upon Jehovah. We need to remember Jesus Christ. You ever wonder why Jesus just chose a few people to be around? And have you ever wondered why on earth did He choose those 12 men that walked with Him on the earth? I realize there's 14 apostles, but we'll talk about the 12. So why did He choose those men? I look at them sometime and say, well, that was certainly a motley crew. And I guess I kind of draw the conclusion that maybe the reason He chose them is that's the best that there were. Now, they didn't come from the walks of life that would have, if they had run for office, their qualifications probably wouldn't have been so great. But Jesus knew something about them. And what He knew is that it was going to take the course of about 3 years with walking under His tutelage to effect change in their life. How do you move this group of fellows from the tax collector to the fisherman to the others that were, whatever their occupations were, how do you move them from here to here? And what the Lord knew is He had to build a bridge in order to effect that change. And that's exactly what needs to happen with individuals as well, is change is affected. Is that better? Change is affected by basically building of a bridge. So it's not just bang, we change, but that change takes place over time. And what we see is the maturity of Simon Peter from impetuous Peter to the elder in the church later on who is advising husbands and wives how to live together. We see a change in this man. How did that change come about? It came about over time, and it came about sometime with pretty stern rebukes from the Lord. But change takes place over time. Sometime age has that effect. We're told in Mark, the 4th chapter, that we need to have faith like a grain of mustard seed. And basically what that's saying is, when you do some study in your how these mustard seeds grow up, a mustard seed is a little small thing, about the size of a flea, if that big, and this thing grows into a huge bush, is what he's talking about. And that we need to have faith, even though it's small, If we have faith and tie that with the desire to change in our lives, then we can have wonderful things, large things that happen from small things. Here's the other thing I know, is that any change affects change. Any small change is going to affect the course that you're going. When we have a husband and a wife, or we have a family unit, and there is some change they make in that family, even a small change, it is going to affect the rest of the family. When one person starts getting healthy, the rest of them are going to have to make a change in response to that, whether they want to get healthy or not. When one person decides, I'm going to be healthy, but as Joshua said, as for me and my house, we'll serve the Lord, whatever the situation was in his family, the rest of the family had to change because Joshua had made a decision and chosen a direction, and the rest of the family had to affect change in that process. We need to look at life through the eyes of Jesus and realize that change is a process, not an event. And what that means is people don't change overnight. It's a process. Now, how do we get people to stay in the process? What we do is we encourage the change and we discourage staying with the familiar. For instance, I am so glad to see the smile on your face. When y'all were out here drinking and going to the bar, you know you didn't smile much. But now that you're not doing that, I'm seeing the smile on your face and you look at peace. You look peaceful. And you're just doing such wonderful things. I just encourage you. Okay, what did we just do in that little conversation? What we did is we talked about how the negative was not productive. And we talked about how the change that we see in your life makes you so much more pleasant and so much more at peace. And we need that language. We need to accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative. You know that old song by Patti Page way back in time. But we need to look at the fact that as people change, that change is reinforced by affirmations. And we need to affirm that the change is a good change. It's so glad to see you. Someone hasn't been coming to service. Maybe they come in once in a while, and you see them for two or three services in a row. It is so glad to see you. We need to affirm that. And what that does, we call that positive reinforcement. But what that does is that just affirms that what the person is doing is right. It's on the right track. We want to encourage you in doing that. In the New Testament, there's a fellow in Acts, the 4th chapter. His name is Joseph. Have you read about him? Joseph. And Joseph was a guy that we pick him up there, and he has made a large donation to the church. And then later on, what we find is that he is one that gives the Apostle Paul the right hand of fellowship. And then we read later on that he goes on one of the missionary journeys, and he takes with him one of his relatives, and that doesn't work out too good. We find later on that he goes on another missionary journey, and there he wants to take his relative, and he even fights for his relative to go with so much that he and one of the other people on that journey run into a problem where they have a strong dispute over whether to take that relative or not. And then we see later on several things about this man, but every time you read about him, you read and it reinforces what kind of a guy he was. Do you know who Joseph is? He's Barnabas. But Barnabas wasn't his name. Barnabas was his nickname. And in Acts, the 4th chapter, you can read about that. And you know who nicknamed him that? The apostles. And it says he was called by the apostles Barnabas, which means son of encouragement. Everything you read about Barnabas, except one thing where he was caught away in a discrimination. But everything you read about Barnabas is encouraging. He's encouraging somebody wherever he is. He's encouraging the church to accept Paul. He's encouraging his nephew to follow in the righteous steps. He's encouraging. Everywhere you read about here, this man is an encourager and sets the example of what God wants you to be. And he's nicknamed by the apostles Encourager. I wonder if we would go around this audience and nickname people, what your nickname would be. Would we have Sister Grumpy and Brother Grouch? what would your nickname be? Now, you know, people in life, even in the New Testament, They walked just like we walk. We're all men of likeness, all people of likeness, and we all have our same frailties, and we all have similar circumstances. And my guess is, if you took a snapshot of folks in New Testament days, you'd have largely a snapshot of what we've got right here before us today. But the thing is that these people grew together, and they came together, and they formed the church, and they turned the world upside down. The apostles did, but also the effects that were going on in the evangelism in these congregations were known throughout the world, to where these folks were called the Way. They were referred to as the ones who have turned the world upside down. They've come here too. And those people live today, but they live in our bodies. We're not reincarnations of them, but we should be duplicates of them in their faith and their continuity with God and with their relationship with Jesus. Do you believe that? That's this generation. We have a mission. We have something to do. We may have our limits, and but we also have our opportunities. And what we need to do is be busy about the Lord's work and be encouragers. So I ask again, if we were to nickname you, what would your nickname be? I suggest that you ask five people to write down on a piece of paper what your nickname would be, and then you see what the composite answer is as to how you're perceived. What would your nickname be? Encourager was what Barnabas' nickname was. Well, we need to also, as we accept change, we need to remember the promises of God. I love the song, Standing on the Promises. We need to do that more than just stand on the premises. We need to stand on the promises, and here's some of the promises. Do you know these promises? I will in no wise forsake you, Hebrews 13:6. Do you believe that? That God is going to be there. He'll be the present help in time of trouble. I will not forsake you. That's a promise. The peace of God, we read about that, will guard us if we do the first part. Trust in the Lord with all of our heart and lean not on our own understanding. There's a promise with that. There's a promise also in Romans the 8th chapter, verse 26 and 27. You read that promise. And what it will tell you is that all things work together for good to those that love the Lord. Do you love the Lord? Then if you do the right thing, that God will work that out in your life. I voted at one point in my life to downsize myself. I was the vice president in a company, and the company was having some financial times. And so one of the things that I suggested in a pretty serious business meeting is this company is going to go under if we don't do something drastic. And so what we did is we voted to downsize the last 13 people that had come in the door. I was one of those people. So I voted to downsize myself. Well, what I decided I would do is that I just needed to feel sorry for myself, even though it had been partly my idea. And medical director and several others were involved in that because they were among the last in the door. So that's just the way we decided to do it. But anyway, I told this to a person, and a person kept asking me what was wrong. And I kept saying, well, it's nothing big, nothing big. Well, it was something big to me. I was about to be out of work. But I downplayed it. You know how people will do that. And finally, this person said, no, something's wrong. I know you and something's wrong. So finally, I said, well, I voted today to downsize myself, and I'm going to be out of work in a month. And this person is a person of faith, and what she said, good. And I thought, well, what a strange response. You know, I want you to tell me, I feel so sorry for you. What are you going to do, Art? How are you going to get your... I wanted all these pity pot kinds of things, and I didn't get that. What I got was good. And that threw me, and I said, well, why would you say that? And then I realized I couldn't be mad, because here was her answer. He closed one door so he could open another. You didn't have the courage to close the door, so he closed it for you with this opportunity, and he's getting ready to open up something bigger and greater. I think I told you this story this week. Been a long weekend. But essentially what happened is that good things have happened to me. And what had happened that I didn't realize is I was having a lapse in my faith. If I trust in the Lord with all my heart, and he's going to provide the things for me that he's promised to provide, I feel like Mork from Ork. That he's going to promise the things he's going to provide the things he promised, then those things will come to be. And in fact, they have in my life. Now, I want to suggest also that I am not alone, that other godly men and women have had things happen in their lives too. And one person, there's an old Indian proverb, and basically what it says is, don't criticize people till you walk a mile in their shoes. But the other part of that, are we on? Okay. The other part of that is that one person said that one time I felt sorry for myself because I had no shoes until I met a man that had no feet. There is always something worse, someone worse off than we are. Sometimes in the life that I live daily, I go home and kind of spank myself. Do you ever spank yourself? And it's like, what is wrong with you? You know, here you're going home to your garage, or to your garage where you put your car. You're going home to your house with all the amenities that are there. And riding along, got food, clothing, shelter, got more than I need, more than I deserve. And I'm riding home feeling sorry for myself. And I've just left people that are out here that they have just come out from under bridges and porches, and they've been sleeping inside of the entryway of stores. And what they've done is they don't have the support systems or the things in life that I have. And here I am feeling sorry for myself. And I just want to suggest, if you feel sorry for yourself, here's what you do. You go down to your local mission and volunteer to dip soup. And I'll guarantee you'll come back feeling different. What I have done is, some of my holidays, I will go down and I will work some of the kitchens as a volunteer. And if you really want to have an experience of how well off you are, and that it ain't all that bad, then you go down and dip soup for folks that don't have anything. Don't look at why they don't have anything, but they don't have anything. And you realize really what it's like to be on the bottom. There's none of us that's on the bottom. We may not have everything we want, but we certainly have a lot more than they have. And so what we need to remember, even godly men and women. When I turn to the book of Hebrews, I read about people that were in chains and in bondage, people that were sawn asunder, people had all kinds of things going on. I've not experienced those kinds of things. And so it can always be worse. That what appears to be bad maybe isn't all that bad. It's something we can survive from. Okay, I want to flip over to guarding our heart, because this is a critical piece, and I'm going to move very quickly through here. But guarding our heart is part of how we're going to affect change in ourselves. That we have to protect what goes in here and what we process out. Do you remember, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks? You remember that passage by Jesus? And what he is simply saying is, what you put in here and what you allow to roll around in here is going to come out in your life. We are products of what we think. As a man thinks in his heart, so is he, we're told. And so the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. What we need as we face life situations, whether it's a mental illness or whether it's a circumstance in life that's got us down, what we need is to approach this with wisdom. What I have seen, a lot of people in their attempt to make change or to put things, something that's broken, back in place too quick, I've seen them make some pretty dumb decisions. And those decisions have come to haunt them. What I often tell people when they come and talk with me is, we had this situation. Well, what did you do about it? Well, I did this. Well, did that work? No, it didn't work. And what that did, in fact, has brought us even more problems. And what I tell them is this little adage, is that your problem is not your problem. Your solution has now become your problem. You see what I'm saying there? Is that you wanted to fix something by doing something that made it worse. And the thing you're doing worse has now become your problem, that we got to fix that before we can go back and fix the real problem. And so now you got a whole strain of things going on. Somebody gets all stressed out and they decide to go down and get tanked up. They go to get drunk. Or they go out and have a fling of some sort. All they've done is made bad matters worse. And now on top of that, they've got other problems. One fellow had an affair, and the next thing we know, he's out drinking his sorrows away. And he decides to drive home that way, and he gets picked up. Now he's in trouble with the judicial system, and he's probably going to go away and do some time. And all the while he's dealing with this DUI or driving under the influence, while he's doing that, the original problem is still sitting there for him when he gets out from under the heat of this problem. Sometimes the solution becomes the problem, or becomes at least an additional problem. And what we need to do when something happens, often rather than to jump and try to immediately fix the thing, we need to stop and think, and a lot of times less harm is done by waiting and making a methodical response rather than jumping in and making matters worse. Sometimes when husbands and wives have conflict, one of the first things the husband will want to do is open his mouth and deny what's going on, and sometimes that means you sleep on the couch, or you may find your stuff thrown out the window and you have to go find a place to sleep tonight. Hopefully that doesn't happen here. But sometimes those things happen because what we do is, in trying to fix the problem, we make the problem worse. So it calls for wisdom, and wisdom may mean that I need to step back a little bit and think about this and kind of come back to this at a time that is good. We can learn wisdom from others who fear the Lord. So someone that has been in a similar circumstance to what we're in and that is a spiritual leader, then they can share and they can help in that. There was a young lady over in Plymouth that used to come forward all the time, and she would come for the prayers of the church. She had a lot of things going on in her life, and I think rightfully asking for the prayers was a good and right thing to do. But she called me aside one night after service, and she said, "Art, I have to stop attending here." And I asked her why. She said, "I'm the only one sinning." Now, she had drawn that conclusion from the point that nobody else was asking for any prayers. Nobody else was saying, "I need your help to correct this problem." What I did know, though, is I talked with her, and we talked her into staying, convinced her she wasn't the only sinner, but she was probably the only one confessing her sins, at least publicly. But we did talk with her about that, and what I knew is in the congregation, there was a lady that had the same past that this lady had that was a little bit more fresh. And this lady had been pretty straight and honest about what was going on with her. I approached the sister that I knew had that past, and I told her, I said, "Sister Tammy really needs you." And her response was, "I don't want anybody to know the life I used to live." Well, I asked her a question. I wonder then why in a book that only has 28 chapters, that three of those chapters are dedicated to the life story, a repetitive story told three times about the life of Saul of Tarsus, where he tells the guy he used to be. And I am convinced that often the very help we need is sitting right in the pews in the congregation. And what that means is, if you've been on a journey that is like the journey someone else is behind you on, share your journey. You don't have to necessarily spill all your details. But if you know, if you're connecting with what that person is going through, then talk with them. They need you. They need your help. They need your encouragement. They need to know that there is hope and that someone has done this and knows how to do it. They need to know that. And so while we all have past, and sometimes we don't want to reminisce on the war stories of our past, and I suggest that's not a good idea to have euphoric recall, but sometimes the way we have been is an opportunity for us to help someone else that's trying to pull out of the way we've been. Does that make any sense? And that's going to call for us to have some self-disclosure. Now, I want to suggest something to you. In doing that, get ready for healing. Because as you share your story, what you will find is your life begins to take a healing process, and you can realize that you came to the kingdom perhaps for even a moment such as this, to help this sister, to help this brother, to help someone else on their way. I've seen this happen many times in my life. And I've seen people who have risen from despair and go on in hope and have gone on to be leaders in the Lord's church. All because someone shared the story in that critical moment. Someone walked with them and someone gave encouragement at a time like that. And so it's a very personal thing. We need to fear the Lord. We need to have wisdom. And we need to answer wisdom's call. You can look there in Proverbs, the first chapter, and understand that. And that's what we're talking about in Proverbs 3, about it letting authentic love lead you daily. If we love our brothers and sisters and we have help, we have things that can encourage them, why would we hold back on resources that would help people to get better? So we guard our hearts, and now what we want to do is to protect our minds. We have to be careful what goes in, and we've talked about that a little bit. And then I also want to suggest that we preserve our emotions. Now, the book of Proverbs, I don't have this verse on here, but the book of Proverbs talks about the person who is first with a story appears to be correct. You ever read that? If not, somebody will hunt that up for you. But here's a person comes and tells a story, and sometimes they appear to be the one that is correct. But there's always at least two sides to a story, and sometimes there's three or four sides to a story. And what I have developed in my practice and in my life is a mantra that says, the truth is in the detail. The truth is in the detail. So when people start telling me stories and it doesn't match, when I start asking them the detail and the detail doesn't match, then somebody's, this story, I don't have the whole story yet. Someone's either misrepresenting or lying, or someone's misunderstood it some way. And if the truth is in the detail, we need that detail. You thought I was going to say the truth will set you free, didn't you? But that's true too. But where is the truth? The truth is in the detail. What you'll find is the truths of God's Word are in the gold mine of the detail that we read about in Scripture. Some of us learned a few things today, perhaps, by digging deep into the detail of the truth. So what I suggest is that when people are upset and when they're emotional, often they don't see the whole story. What they may have done is they may have misunderstood what's going on. They may have clearly understood what's going on, but something's going on, and now we have responses. Anger is not the first response. Often, people who are hurt will respond first by lashing out in anger or with a quick-tempered response. There are other responses. Sometimes, I remember a fellow that told me, he said, you know, I was out riding in my car, and somebody blew through the stop sign, and I nearly pulled out in front of them. I was so angry. And then what they did, they actually were heading to the hospital to visit somebody, and they saw that car pulled up at the emergency room, and someone and the people in there were helping the person get out. Someone had an emergency. They blew through a stop sign, and that may have infuriated the person that didn't understand what was going on. But the first response was anger. Isn't that awful? And that is our first response sometime, isn't it? But beyond the anger, maybe we need to have some understanding and realize that people are going to aggravate us. And Ephesians 4 is a favorite verse, but I'm not going to have time to develop that this evening. But anger and sometimes fear. People tell us something and it scares us. We don't know what to do about it. Or other times, our response may be worrying. All those responses can be destructive. We want to be careful we don't let the sun go down on our wrath. So we need to protect our emotions, and we also need to prop up our will. And we do that by remembering who we are. We've got several here who've been in the military. And when we are involved in warfare, that's not the time to leave your weapon back in the barracks. When there's a war going on, it's time to rally the troops and get in here and fight the battle. And we, as people in God's army, need to remember that the weapons of our warfare, Ephesians 5 talks about the Christian soldier, and you recall that passage, but it also, over in 2 Corinthians, talks about how the weapons of our warfare are not carnal. And so why would we use carnal weapons in a spiritual war? Sometimes the devil tries to get to us, yes, through our husbands and wives and boyfriends and girlfriends and children. And the devil tries to get to us, and sometimes he's very successful in doing that. But what are the weapons of our warfare? We take the higher road. We know that a soft answer turns away wrath. We know there's tools in the Bible. These are new tools that are not like we used when we were in the world. But these are new tools, a new response to life and a response to people. And those are the tools we need to use. Now, I don't by any means want to make you think that we need to be pushovers, because there is a time to have godly emotions. We talked about emotions before. Godly emotions. Did you realize that that not all the things that are wrong are wrong? Not all the things that we list as wrong are wrong. We say, oh, you shouldn't be jealous. That's sinful. Really? I am jealous over you with a godly jealousy. Does all jealousy get thrown out? No. Unrighteous jealousy does. But there is a godly jealousy. Someone says, oh, it's not right to hate. Don't be hating. Really? Oh, how I love thy law. Therefore, I hate every false way. I want to suggest to you that for everything that is a wrong emotion, there is a counterpart that is a proper place for that same emotion. You take a look at that and see if I overstated that. So let us not be namby-pamby and think it's wrong to have any feelings, but let's have those feelings on the right end of the spectrum, where they are in the godly range and not in the ungodly range. We need to look for opportunities and accept challenges, and above all, we need to stay on the course, hold it steady, and the way you do that is we run the race that is before us, looking unto Jesus, who is the author and perfecter of our faith. Back before my cancer days, I used to run 3 to 5 miles a day, and I weighed about 145 pounds at that time, and I really enjoyed doing some of the stuff I did then. I can't do that now. But one of the things I learned in racing is that I have to keep my eye on what the goal is. I have to know where the finish line is. And more than one time, I got pretty weary in running my races and my 5Ks and all that stuff. And I'd get real weary, but what I would do is I would look to that finish line, and I would see it's just a few more steps, just a few more strides, and I'll be home. And that's the way it is for us, that we cannot afford to take our eye off the goal. We may have our baggage. We may have our mental problems and our emotional disturbances. We may have a normal and straight life, whatever that is. But whatever the situation is, we cannot afford to take our eyes off of the finish line. We cannot afford to take our eyes off of Jesus, who is the author and perfecter of our faith. I don't care what it is that holds us back. What it is we need to do is to accept the situation we have in life, change it where we can, help others that are in the same situation we're in, and keep our eyes on Jesus, who's the author and perfecter of our faith. I've enjoyed so much being with you this weekend, and I hope somehow some of the things we have said will help you as we try to make it across the finish line together. That's what it's about. If I don't see you again, see you in heaven. May God bless us all to that end. Is someone here tonight that needs to respond to the gospel? Someone that needs to ask for the prayers of the church? Or someone that needs to confess something so you can go home kind of unburdened from whatever's troubling you? Whatever your situation is, if we can help you with prayer, or if you need to be baptized into Christ this evening and become a New Testament Christian, then the invitation is to you, and we're wanting and willing to help you in any way we can, aren't we? If you'll come while we stand and sing this song.